This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Matt Stone, co-created the animated comedy series South Park with Trey Parker. Now Parker and Stone have a new movie called Team America World Police. It's a send-up of action films, and all the roles are played by marionettes. The premise is Team America, an international anti-terrorist police force, is hunting down a terrorist cell which possesses weapons of mass destruction. In an early scene, the Team America force goes to Paris. They take aim at terrorists hiding out there, but, oops, they miss the terrorists and accidentally blow up the Eiffel Tower. They need help infiltrating the terrorist group, so they recruit the one actor good enough to convincingly pose as a terrorist, the star of the Broadway musical Lease. Lease is the filmmaker's hilarious parody of the musical Rent. Every convention of action films is satirized in this movie, and these clichés look particularly ludicrous enacted by puppets. We see marionettes talking tough, shooting automatic weapons, blowing other marionettes through plate glass windows. And there are tender moments in which marionettes passionately make love. Politically, the film mocks everyone, arrogant Americans, terrorists, dictators, the UN, and celebrities turned political activists. Here's a scene in which Kim Jong-il, sounding very much like one of the kids on South Park, is in his palace about to greet Hans Blix.
Hans Blix going to Park.
Hans Blix? Oh, no! Oh, hello. Great to see you again, Hans.
Mr. Il, I was supposed to be allowed to inspect your palace today, and your guards won't let me into certain areas.
Hans, we've been through this a dozen times. I don't have any weapons of mass destruction, okay, Hans?
Then let me look around so I can ease the UN's collective mind. I'm sorry, but the UN must be firm with you. Let me see your whole palace or else.
Or else what?
Or else we will be very, very angry with you, and we will write you a letter telling you how angry we are.
Okay. I'll show you, Hans. You ready? Stand ready to your left. Read them all. Good. Ah! There you go, Hans Blix!
What we're hearing is Hans Blix falling through a trap door into a giant fish tank where he's eaten by a piranha, a takeoff from a scene in a James Bond film. I asked Matt Stone what inspired him to do a big action film using marionette puppets.
About that time, The Day After Tomorrow, the global warming movie, was sold to Fox, and it was this big splash in the trades about how they got this huge, there was a spec script, they got all this money. And the one-liner that they were selling the movie on, like sudden global warming causes worldwide catastrophe and causes massive flooding and all these people dying, was just hilarious to us. And I mean, it turned out to be pretty funny in the movie as it ended up. But just even as a pitch, it was a funny pitch. So we got, through our agents, we got a copy, an advance copy of the script, you know, before The Day After Tomorrow was even shot. And we realized it's like, this is it. This is what we should do with puppets. You know, it just reeked of that overwrought, you know, big budget, trying to hit, you know, 15 locations around the world, you know, having all these different characters, figuring out a way to flood New York City and then figuring out a way to freeze it, you know, figuring out all these things just so you could have all these set pieces. And it was really then that we were just like, that's what we should do with puppets. The bigger and more overwrought, the better. And then later it kind of developed into a political thing with the world police concept and everything. But it was a combination of just being kind of raised on big overwrought Hollywood action movies, Bruckheimer movies, Roland Emmerich movies, and being inspired by Thunderbirds and Gerry Anderson.
Now, you know, one of the really funny scenes in the movie is a send-up of the love scene that is in every action film, where, like, the two characters kiss for the first time, and then, well, particularly in, like, 80s movies, this turns into, like, the rock video sequence. It's going to be, like, lifted out and used as the rock video. So there's, like, an irritating, awful love ballad playing in the background, and the characters, they kiss for the first time, then they take off their clothes, and then she runs her finger down his tight abs. And then they start to really go at it and have sex. But you want to describe the puppet version of this?
When we first thought of the idea, Trey is a huge musical fan and basically like wants to do a musical out of everything. And originally he's like, we got to do a musical about this. But then musical, what wouldn't work with the Bruckheimer action movie. There was just no way to get both those things to work. And the more we kind of looked at Bruckheimer movies, the more we realized that they really are kind of musicals. And even those movies that aren't musicals, and then you're like, you're talking about the kind of cheesy 80 movies where people have the kiss and then they fall in love and it cuts to a song. That's kind of a musical. It's, you know, it's kind of a music video version of a musical.
Exactly.
But yeah, that's we did a lot of those kind of songs in the movie, and there's always the, you know, you have to have that one where, you know, they kiss for the first time and you cut in, and usually in a lot of movies I cut and it's the next morning in bed. But of course we didn't want to do that. We wanted to have puppets have sex. And of course, because they're puppets, we thought we could just do anything with them and get away with it. But the joke was supposed to be, and the joke could be in a live action movie too, that they're going to kiss for the first time and then they end up just having this 2-minute, like, well, a condensed 8-hour sexcapade. But in our version, it was about a 2-minute sex-making, love-making scene between the puppets that the MPAA had us cut down to about 40 seconds.
Yeah, well, I found that interesting. I read that the MPAA wanted to give you, what was it, an NC-17?
Or, yeah, I mean, what you do in the MPAA is you submit it to the MPAA, and then sometime 2 days later, you get back a NC-17 or an R. You get your rating, and they get an NC-17, and they said you had to. And we're contractually obligated to deliver an R movie, and the movie should be rated R. We wanted it to get a wide release, so we had to cut it back to an R. And, you know, I mean, I think the scene survives, and the movie is obviously, you know, more than about just two puppets having sex, but it'll give us a lot more unrated DVD sales because now everyone's really like, oh my God, what'd they do?
Now, while we're on the subject of what rating boards have to say about your movie, I understand the British Board of Film Classification, in its discussion of what rating to give your movie in England, said terrorism isn't funny.
Right, yes. Brilliant observation by the Brits there. Yes.
Well, first of all, how did that affect the rating they gave you? And second of all, what's your reaction to that? Terrorism isn't funny. I mean,
I don't know. I think that obviously, you know, there's a lot about terrorism that isn't funny at all. But I think, like almost every subject in the world, there are funny aspects to it. And you know, this movie, and it's been a hard tone to find out how to make this subject matter funny, because to us, I think you can. To Trey and I, we've always had the ethic that you can write jokes and write comedy about anything you want, and it doesn't mean that you don't think that stuff is important or that there aren't extremely dire aspects to things, but humor is how a lot of people deal with things, and humor is how Trey and I deal with things. So, for instance, we have in the movie, all the terrorists talk basically in this Arabic gibberish, which they just go, you know, Durka Durka Muhammad Ali, and they talk like Muhammad Jihad, and they just kind of talk like this, you know. All we use is Muhammad Jihad Allah Durka Durka Burka Burka, and that's how they talk. And that to me is what terrorists sound like when I look at their little tapes that they release, and all it is us making fun of terrorists. I don't think we're making fun of terrorism so much as belittling terrorists, which you know, we're big fans of like the Warner Brothers World War II cartoons. And even Disney did some World War II cartoons where they would actually have Bugs Bunny, you know, going at it with. But they have one where he's going out with Hitler, one with Tojo, and they're incredible. And you know, the one with Tojo is so racist now they won't show it. But it's like, to me, so much more interesting to watch those cartoons. I think you get a better indication of how people were feeling at that time than you do reading, you know, a newspaper from 1944, because. It's obvious even back then people could see that making fun of Hitler was psychologically empowering. It wasn't, you know, and this was like Bugs Bunny putting on a little helmet and pretending to be a World War II soldier. And it didn't at all diminish the cause against fascism, but it just was psychologically empowering to take this, you know, take Hitler and make him into a cartoon character and hit him over the head with a hammer. And I think that's what we try to do with terrorism and with Kim Jong-il in this movie.
When you were doing the voices of the terrorists and of Kim Jong-il, where is the line you had to walk between, kind of mocking terrorists and mocking Kim Jong-il and not making it seem like you were mocking Muslims or mocking anyone Asian?
Language-wise, I again point back to the World War II cartoons with Bugs Bunny and Tojo, or Bugs Bunny and Hitler, where they would just make fun of German and Japanese, and they'd be very racist, drawings of like Tojo. But to me, it's like these people are our enemy. And once they're our enemy, you can use any tool you want to make them feel, to psychologically, you know, make yourself feel better than them and to make fun of them. So I don't know. For us, it never really was a problem. We Trey and I kind of grew up in during the political correctness heyday of the 80s and 90s, and I never really understood it, and I still don't. And we never... I really don't understand political correctness, so it never even enters our conversations. It was so obvious that we were making fun of Kim Jong-il and making fun of terrorists, and it never even entered our mind that anybody would be offended by that.
Matt Stone is my guest, and he and Trey Parker are the creators of South Park and of the new movie, which is called Team America. Another thing that's really funny about the plot, I mean, in the plot, you know, Team America is an international police force fighting terrorism, and the team recruits a young star of Broadway musicals to join because he's the only actor good enough to really go undercover and pretend he's a terrorist and infiltrate
right.
the terrorists. And but of course, you know, one guy on the team looks down on him because he's really just an actor. And that's such a staple of so many like cop shows on TV, you know, mm-hmm. where like the actor who's going to play a cop on TV mm-hmm. goes to the precinct to study what the real cops are like. But of course, this is a television series, so the real cops who are looking down on the actor are really actors themselves who are playing
yeah.
a cop in the TV series. But in this movie, it's all that except that they're puppets. They're not even actors, so it's a scream. It's really funny.
Well, there's just always, in every one of those movies, there's always, in any team movie, there's like Aliens I'm thinking of, or in Top Gun, or any one where you have this team or a class, or hey, we've got to go do it, you know, Predator. I'm just getting cheesy action movies, you know. Well, The Predator's a great movie, too, but there always is that character that's just an antagonist. He's not the antagonist of the movie, but he's just an antagonist to the main character. And he's just I don't know how to say it other than crudely, but he's just, what do I say? He's just mean, like Iceman and Top Gun, just for no reason, just inexplicably. He's like, hey, man, you think you're tough? Well, you're not that tough. He's like, who's this guy? You know, it always comes out of nowhere, and he always has kind of a crew cut. It was Val Kilmer in Top Gun, and there's another guy in Aliens that's that way, and they're always in the way of they're always kind of questioning the protagonist, like, can you do it? Can you do it? And it's like, and it's just a cheesy device to inject some conflict into some scenes where you're introducing the concept of, for instance, in this movie, you have to spend time introducing the concept of Team America, and you have to introduce Gary to all the characters, and you have to do this in a lot of movies. Well, there's no conflict in those kind of scenes. And, you know, as any movie screenwriter knows, a scene without conflict is not much fun to watch. So what they do is they just invented this device, which is Iceman in Top Gun, who's like, hey, you think you're tough? You know, like this guy comes out of nowhere and just hates the lead character for no reason and just gets in his way. So that's what Chris is in Team America.
Do you do any of the voices in the movie?
Yeah, I do a couple. Trey does some, and we got, you know, a few people to help us out this time because they're all, Trey and I are kind of out of voices. We do them on South Park, and, you know, we've done a few, and we don't really have that many voices, and just, even in this movie, it all kind of starts sounding the same, but we just kind of don't care. It all comes out of necessity, not because we think we're really great voiceover artists.
Well, the Korean dictator, Kim Jong-il, sounds exactly like one of the characters on South Park.
Trey. Yeah, that's Trey, and that's Trey's, especially because Kim Jong-il kind of took on this new thing where he started screaming a lot in the movie, where he had very, very little patience. When Trey screams, he kind of just always sounds like Cartman. So people have been kind of comparing him to Cartman. But Cartman's a great character, and I think if Cartman got his own small Asian country, he would probably run it much like Kim Jong-il runs North Korea. Well, again, it was like everything else. There wasn't one instant where it was like, oh, here, we should do this. This would be a great idea. It was an evolution of ideas. And it was a combination of a voice that Trey and I would do in college that would make our film teacher mad as hell, where we would make fun of him with this little, like, stupid voice, and which basically became Cartman. And Trey's drawing style, which is about the only thing he can do, which is basically the South Park drawing style. And out of necessity, again, out of some, I think it was some assignment or something, we had to do a little animated cartoon. We'd used construction paper cutouts and did stop motion animation because neither of us could really draw that well. And, you know, and put that little voice that was annoying our teacher, put it on the kid, these little kids, and that's kind of how it started.
Now, Kyle, one of the characters that you do the voice of, is like the Jewish kid in the story.
Yeah.
And you're Jewish.
Yeah.
What are some of the characteristics you wanted to give Kyle in this largely Christian neighborhood?
I think Kyle being Jewish was more Trey's idea than mine. Because even though I'm Jewish simply because I look Jewish, because my mom is Jewish, and so I am Jewish, but I grew up completely secular and completely agnostic and completely unaware of the fact that I was Jewish until I was probably 17, which is probably better, because I remember there was a little Jewish kid where I grew up named, I'm not going to name him, but I can't remember, it was Greg something, in our junior high school. Man, he got his ass kicked all the time just for being Jewish. And that's how cruel kids can be, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Nothing too major, but probably pretty traumatic, and Greg's probably pretty screwed up from it. So I'm actually kind of glad that I didn't end up too Jewish-looking where I grew up. I think it was more Trey's idea. Like, I mean, even though I did the voice of Kyle, it was funny to make him actually that was his identity and stuff. It doesn't really have any bearing upon me because I am the worst Jew in the world. I know nothing about the religion. I'm completely agnostic. My poor mother, she's, you know.
South Park is really about seeing the world through the eyes of not very bright third graders who are sometimes mean-spirited and often really annoying and obviously really adolescent, because they are adolescent. Why are you so interested in that point of view?
You know, it just gives you great latitude because, you know, when we started doing South Park, and I guess it was 95, 96, 97, I mean, we grew up in the late, you know, the 80s and the 90s, when this whole image, this whole kind of thing of through the eyes of a child, because children are so innocent, and if we could just see the world through the eyes of a child, and we just took that and basically turned it on its ear, because to me, children are the incarnation of evil. I mean, they're so self-interested. They're so greedy. Naturally, they are just that way. And children need to be taught manners and need to be taught limitations. And it really, I think, and it's something that's, I think it's fundamental to South Park, and a lot of people don't see it, but Trey and I definitely do, that there's an extremely different worldview that goes along with South Park than other shows, which is society basically makes us good. We're not born good and society makes us bad. That there is a certain public kind of trust between everyone, and that's the only thing keeping us from all killing each other. And children need to be taught that. And you see that in South Park all the time, that the kids, when they're unguarded, just go off and do the most asinine things and the most evil things. And they need to be taught by the parents, who a lot of times are, you know, hypocritical and not even following their own advice. You know, they need to be taught limitations and they need to be taught these things, because if not, you know, if they're left their own devices, they're just evil.
There's a classic episode of South Park in which the four-letter word for excrement that starts with an SH, which
yes,
we can't say on
word.
The radio, where it becomes okay, it becomes legitimate to use that word in school, and no one's going to punish you for it. And then people start using that word over and over and over again in school and in town, and it turns out if you say that word too much, you get really ill. You get some kind of awful like intestinal
virus. Right,
because
it's a cursed word. There's a curse on it.
Exactly, because it's a cursed word, yes. But it's so thrilling for the kids at first to be able to say that word in school.
Right.
What did curse words mean to you when you were a kid? Like, what power did they have?
I don't really remember. I remember I was not allowed really to curse around my parents, and it wasn't this explicit thing where they said you can't say that. But it was just, I had a level. My parents was like, there was just a level of decorum that I just had different rules around my parents than with my peers. So it was just, I don't know, for me it was just freedom. And those words are so powerful because they are taboo and they're so good. Like I cuss way too much in my normal life. I'm terrible. I have a terrible mouth. I can shut it off, you know, for an interview like this, but mm-hmm. I'm one of those people that really people sometimes go, man, you need to like lay off because you just use the F word way too much. And I am that way. It's just, I don't know. Maybe I should have learned more limitations when I was growing up. But that's like, I mean, that's the fun part of South Park. And that's what's so funny to me about like the current, you know, thing going on with the FCC and with Howard Stern and stuff, is it's an interesting line, because at one hand, like we kind of like, people say, well, you're fighting the same fight that Howard Stern is fighting to be able to say whatever you want to say. And it's kind of true. But on the other hand, it's like those limitations on what you can say on cable, on advertiser-supported cable, is what the standards that we're always bumping up against. And it's that friction that makes it funny. If there weren't any standards at all, I don't know if we would change South Park a whole lot and have it be a language free-for-all, because I just don't know how fun that is.
So how did you get permission from Comedy Central to use the S-word? I think it was 162 times.
Yeah, well, we called them and we said, we want to do this show. We have this concept and we think it's kind of smart to do it this way. And they thought it was great. And they basically called the advertisers and said, are you okay with this? And they said, yeah, for, you know, as long as it didn't become every day, if it's this kind of thing and we're behind you. And they actually got advertisers to support them on it. So it was fine. I mean, if they can, but on a regular basis, you know, they aren't sure even in, you know, reruns and stuff, that they don't want to have all these limitations all the time. So they have to check with the advertisers. Are you okay with advertising with this or with this? So in that particular instance, all the advertisers are like, sure, go for it, which is pretty cool, actually.
Isaac Hayes is a recurring character in South Park. He plays a chef, and he's the chef and the coach at the school. And he's like one of the great, you know, soul singers of the 70s, and he did the theme from Shaft, mm-hmm. one of my favorite. And how did you get him? How did you think of him? And then how did you convince him to do South Park?
All right, hold on a second. you know, when we got the order to do the show, it was like, it became kind of this weird, you know, we were like, oh my God, we have 6 episodes of a show that's going to go on the air. It's like, who can we get? So we called, my favorite band at the time was Primus. We literally just wrote them a letter saying, would you please do the theme song? And they did. So it was like dream come true, number one. And then actually with Chef, Trey and I were doing all the voices, and me or Trey wanted to do that voice. We were going to be like, hey, what's going on, children? And just kind of do that voice ourselves. And we're going to pitch it down so it was really, really low. Like an older black man's voice, how they can just be really, really low. And we wanted to do it ourselves. At the time, Comedy Central was like, you can't do that. And it's kind of true in a lot of Disney cartoons and a lot of other cartoons. They won't let their gender, their race specific with the voiceover. They won't allow a white person to do a black person's voiceover. Probably don't care the other way. But at the time, they were like, you know, you need to have a black person do this. And we're like, well, you know, we had this character who sings all these soul songs. Like, why don't we get our soul songs? So we had a really short list. It was Isaac Hayes was our first choice. Then I think we got Lou Rawls on there. And what's the other guy? Barry White. And so we sent out tapes to him. I don't think we ever heard from Lou Rawls. Barry White respectfully declined because he was a very Christian. He's a very Christian man, and he thought it didn't reach his standards. We sent out The Spirit of Christmas. And Isaac Hayes called back and said, sure, I'll do it. So Trey and I flew to New York to record Isaac Hayes. We were so freaked out. You know, we'd never even worked with anybody except for our own friends in Colorado. And here we are doing Isaac Hayes. So then Isaac Hayes shows up. He has no idea what he's going to do. So now we're sitting there, he goes, all right, what's going on? And his agent had basically just said, yeah, you know, he's into it. He wants to do it. But Isaac really was like, you know, just going to a gig to do a voiceover. And so we had to sit there and explain to him, well, you're this big, fat, black guy that lives in this little town in Colorado. You're the only black person and you sing soul songs. And he was like, okay, that sounds good. So we're like, all right. And Trey was actually, this is funny, Trey was actually so freaked out because he had to sing this song that Trey, who's the brilliant musician of the two of us, I'm a lower level musician, went to the bathroom and made me teach Isaac how to sing that song, which was the most ridiculous. If there was a camera crew there, that would have been the funniest thing in the world. Watching me try to teach Isaac Hayes how to sing a song.
What did you have to teach him that he wouldn't have already known?
Well, just now, I mean, you know, he's like, we had a list, we had a temp track. He's like, no, we didn't have a temp track. That's right. We just had the music track. And he's like, how's it go? And Trey ran away and went to the bathroom because he was so afraid. So I had to sit there and go, I'm going to make love to you, woman. I'm going to take you down by the fire. So he would sit there and go, I'm going to make love to you. No, I'm like, no, don't hit that note. I'm going to make love to you, woman. And the fact that I was sitting there, you know, teaching this song, this little ditty to this soul legend was just, it was just unbelievable. But I did an all right job. I got the stuff across to him, and then he took it and ran. But that was one of those times where I was just like, man, Trey, damn it. Get back here. Trey freaked out and ran away.
Another South Park question. There was a long period, I don't think this is still happening, when Kenny, the character Kenny, one of the kids in South Park, died a violent death every week. How did you decide that was going to be like a ritual each week?
That came from the original, when we did the original first cartoon Trey and I ever did together, it was called The Spirit of Christmas, and it was actually the kids had to fight Frosty the Snowman, and in it, Kenny died. You know, the kids yell, oh my God, they killed Kenny, you bastard. And then we came out to Hollywood, and our friend wanted us to do another Christmas card, and we really just wanted the four boys back together, and no one had ever really seen the other one, you know what I mean? So we just did it again and killed him again because it didn't really matter. And then I was like, you guys, people want you to do a TV show based on this. So I was like, well, hell, we want the four boys back together, but we'd already killed them in this little thing. But, you know, who had ever seen it? But a lot of people had seen, you know, that. So then we just came up with the idea that, well, what if he just dies all the time? And that was actually one of the biggest, I want to say fights, but struggles we had with, like, the network. And all of our writer friends were like, you can't do that. That won't work. We're like, no, he'll die every episode, and he'll just inexplicably be back next week. And they're like, and they were probably right in a way. They're like, it'll ruin the logic of the show. You can't kill off a character and bring it back every week. It just, you won't question, you won't be with the character, all this stuff. And it was one of those things where Trey and I don't know why, we just kind of stuck to our guns on that one for some reason. Everyone was like, don't do it, don't do it. And we did it, and it turned out to be a really good decision because people really liked it. But then we did it for about, God, I don't know, 70 episodes or something. 5 years, we killed off Kenny every year. And it really started to become a pain in the butt because we would get the whole episode written, and then we would just animate the end of the show without Kenny there. And Kenny's such kind of a prop anyway. It's so hard to make a character out of him anyway because you can't really hear him. And we started having it started to be a pain in the butt to have to, you know, think of how he died. So we just decided, let's just not kill him anymore for some. And then we'll kill him. Sometimes we won't. We've always been like that on South Park. As soon as it became the rule, we always tried to break the rule. So, like, in the first season, Chef sang a song in every episode. And as soon as that became a liability, we're like, sorry, Chef doesn't need to sing anymore. And that's always been, I think that's one of the reasons why the show remains at least fresh for us, which is important, is because we never get that feeling like, okay, factory time, how are we going to kill Kenny? You know, and we've always been that way. As soon as there's a rule, we're just going to break it.
Well, I want to thank you a whole lot for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you very much. It was cool.
Matt Stone, he and Trey Parker co-created South Park and the new movie Team America.